Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello everyone, welcome to a very special Tuesday Night Jaw Meets episode on the Distraction Pieces Network, recorded in a hotel room somewhere near Brighton last week whilst I was hanging out with everyone on the NXT tour of the UK. I had a great week. I'll get to more of that in a second. But my guests, this came about because one of them just texted me and said, do you know what would be a good idea for your podcast? My guests this week are William Regal and Robbie Brookside, two men who've been best friends for over 30 years, just having a chat in a hotel room. We talk for an hour and 40 minutes. We barely scratch the surface of what they could have spoken about. It's a great chat. I was super pleased to do this. They're both my friends. William Regal texted me and said, why don't me and Robbie chat on your podcast? Won't that be cool? He's right. It is cool. And I'll get into that chat and a little bit about the NXT tour in just a second. Better get the plugs out of the way first. Obviously, my wrestling company, Progress Wrestling. ProgressWrestling.com for tickets to our show in New York on August the 12th. And our huge show at Alexandra Palace. I think there's about 150 tickets left for that now. Our huge show at Alexandra Palace on Sunday, September the 10th in London. They're the only two shows you can actually buy tickets for at the moment. Everything else is sold out, as seems to be our way. So progresswrestling.com for that. Demand-progress.com. So if you want to watch all of our shows, including the Super Strong Style 16 weekend, which if I had to put my name to something in wrestling, not just in wrestling, in all of my careers, comedy, writing, everything I've ever done, I think the Super Strong Style 16, the three shows that constitute that weekender, are some of the best things I've ever been involved with. Huge credit to all the talent involved in it. But I know myself, John and Glenn, super pleased with how that went. So if you want to go and watch them, you can. It's about a fiver or roughly about $7.50 to subscribe for a month. And you can watch all our shows. So, you know, maybe go and do that. Demand-progress.com. Obviously, support everything on the Distraction Pieces Network. Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces podcast. Hardcore Listing, Say Why to Drugs. And the Stop and Search podcast. All tremendously educational, even for someone like me. Certainly the Say Why to Drugs episodes, super educational for someone like me who is very, I'm straight edge, I'm very anti-drugs, but I think they're wonderful educational tools if you just want to know a neutral viewpoint rather than believing what you read in the press or believing what people who are pro something say. I think it's a super cool thing to do. Hardcore Listing is great. Stop and Search is great. Obviously, Distraction Pieces is great because it's Pip's podcast and it's the reason when I was a guest on it that I do this podcast. So I think that's awesome. So support all the other podcasts on the Distraction Pieces Network. That makes me happy if you do that. And to support this podcast, there will be merch soon. I keep promising it you. I've been very busy. I go to America this week, so I'm still super busy. But there will be Tuesday Night Jaw merch at some point. But if you want to support in a different way, then make sure you rate or review us on iTunes or wherever you choose to get your podcast from. Tell people about this podcast. Tweet about it. Copy me on the tweet, at Jim Smallman. Use the hashtag Tuesday Night Jaw. Or point people at my website where I've got a list of all the episodes that we've done and all the best ways that you can subscribe. So that's jimsmallman.com/TNJ. Lowercase. Doesn't work in uppercase for some reason. But jimsmallman.com/TNJ. Lowercase. I also recorded a podcast. You probably saw me tweeting about it. I'm not going to mention who it is. I recorded a podcast with someone else involved in NXT that we can't put up just yet for reasons. That'll be up soon. So it might be in a week, might be in 6 months. Don't know, but I've recorded it and it's in the can, as it were. And I'll be recording some more cool ones with various guests over the course of the next couple of weeks. I know a lot of people like the roundtables. There's not going to be any roundtables this month. I know there's two WWE pay-per-views this month. There's not going to be any roundtables because I'm dead busy. I've spent all this week hanging out as part of the NXT tour. You may have briefly seen me accidentally. I didn't want to be on camera. But you may have briefly seen me on Sky News visiting Adam and Lily, who were involved in the caught up in the terror attack in Manchester. And WWE, I mean, I asked a question through William Regal, would it be possible to get Lily some stuff? Because she's a huge wrestling fan, she's only 8 years old, and they came through and then some, sent FedEx the big box to my house, which I then delivered along with Progress Super Strong Style 16 banner that had been signed by everybody who was at the show, which was really, really cool. I managed to give that to Adam. She also got visited by Bobby Roode and by Mark Andrews and by Nikki Cross, and it was really sweet of WWE letting me tag along with that. It's nothing to do with me. They already had the idea to do it. They'd seen on social media that they were wrestling fans. It's not my doing at all. WWE did it all themselves. And you know when you read about these visits, first of all, I'm a parent, so it got me. Like, you know, hearing how poorly Lily had been and Adam's other half, Lauren, was still in hospital at the time, like that, it really choked me up. Because they're good people and they got caught up in something horrible. But Lily is the bravest little girl. Such a cool kid to have chatted to and spent time talking to. And just watching her with Bobby Roode and Nikki Cross and Mark Andrews, like they were her new best mates. And she got to FaceTime Sasha Banks, who's another one of her favourites. And watching those guys with her, someone like Bobby Roode's done it before, but just so much time. There was no time limit on anything. They just got to sit there and chat and you know, super, super into just talking to her and hearing about her and chatting about wrestling and making her laugh. And it was a really, really cool thing. And I think it's the side of wrestling that people don't see. I'm an independent wrestling promoter. Like, we don't have the reach to do stuff like that, but WWE do. And getting to see them do that was just a genuine highlight of my week, as well as being able to go to the shows in Aberdeen and in Brighton and in Leeds. I enjoyed all of them. Massively, really did. And I chatted to some Progress and Tuesday Night Jaw fans at the show in Brighton. A couple of people came up and high-fived me, which was really, really cool. But no, it was good. It was a really cool experience. I got to see it. I got to see a lot of wrestling in the space of a week and see some current friends and see some old friends. And it was, you know, it was a great experience. So I'm super grateful to WWE for just letting me tag along. I've had a great week. So another podcast will be coming up soon, but this podcast you get now. So go and listen to William Regal and Robbie Brookside, two national treasures, two of the most fantastic people ever to have been involved in professional wrestling, just having a chat with me for a bit. I'm barely involved. Little apology. William Regal had a cold, so he was coughing a little bit. I've cut out quite a lot of the coughing. And obviously, there's three of us around a portable recorder in a hotel room, and I'm sat on the bed, so occasionally you can hear me creaking because I've got really bad sciatica and I had to move every now and again. So apologies for those little sound things. Apart from that, I've listened to it and gone back through it and made sure everything sounds pretty cool. So yeah, enjoy it. I'll catch you on the other side. Cheers, guys.
Gentlemen.
Hello.
Good. It's a good start, Mr.
Yeah.
Regal. Mr. Brookside.
Yeah. Good afternoon.
Thanks. First of all, thanks for doing this. This was your idea, Mr. Regal, because you texted me and said, do you know what would be a laugh for your podcast? Is if you get me and Robbie Brookside together. So that's what we're doing. And I have to ask all these questions, and I'm aware today I'm probably not going to be required that much, so I'm going to sit back and listen to you two talk. So, how long have you known each other?
Right, we started... We first met in 1985, is that correct?
That is correct.
Is it 85 or 86?
No, 85.
85. Yes. At the Carla Grant in Fleetwood, which is a caravan park.
Nice.
Which was a regular show for Bobby Barron of Worldwide Wrestling Promotions of Blackpool, which is what his company was called, where we both... Bob was a wonderful fella who started us both. in his own way. And he was the fella that used to run the Pleasure Beach and then had like loads of little shows in and around Blackpool and the northwest coast and sometimes further afield. And we spent a week together. And the first day, I was a regular on the crew, and Robbie had been a regular on the crew 2 years earlier than that. Is that correct? And then
3 years.
3 years. And then so Robbie came back for the week, which was unexpected to me. He came back and worked for Bob for the week. And the first thing I remember is saying hello to him, and our pal, Peter Thompson, who used to wrestle as Steve Fury, who's well known within the industry as Peter the Thief.
You've told me about him before.
Yeah, Peter. Peter's like the king of the wind-up merchants. And I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, anybody's listening, I've got a bit of a cold, so I sound like an old goose today.
There's an air of Barry White about it.
Yes. So, Robbie's obviously a... yeah. Hey, we'll get to that in a bit, because he was one of her favourites.
He was, wasn't he?
Yeah.
The cassette.
Yeah. So, Robbie had his Everton kit on and his Everton hat, his baseball kit. Would it be called a baseball kit? It was an Everton hat.
Yeah, but I never used to wear kits, but I had a baseball
cap. Yeah. So he left it in the dressing room and went off to get a drink. And our friend Peter, I'm just sat there watching. He got a little bits of paper and put Liverpool on it and stuck it over where it was and everything he had that said Everton. So that was the first. I'm just sat there like, and that was sort of Peter in a nutshell. He was there was a lot of things happened at the Carlagram, weren't there? That like I'm sure you had your experiences. I had mine there. My favourite one was there used to be a compere there. I won't say his name to save him any further embarrassment. But he was a lovely fella, and he was always on about his dad. His dad my dad's in the business for me. You know, I've been in the business my whole life, been in show business, brought up in show business. My dad's, great act, and so what's your dad do? His dad had a budgie act, which is a, for Americans listening, is a performing parakeet.
They don't call, little bird, isn't
it? Yeah, they don't call them budgies in America, they're parakeets.
Right.
But. It was a bit of a variety act at the time.
You ride a tiny bike.
Well, right. So you have like the little budgies and the parakeets, and you have them walking up little slides, and they're there's a full act with them, and they ride little bikes, and it's like a variety act. Well, in Blackpool, which was 7 miles from the Carlagran, at the circus there was the world's best budgie act, which was Norman Barrett, who was the ringmaster at Blackpool Tower Circus.
Right.
And he was very famous for being there for 25 years or something. And so he was like the king of the budgie acts. He was the ringmaster, but part of the circus twice a day was him doing his budgie act. And he was on the Ed Sullivan Show doing it. And, you know, he went all over the world doing the budgie act in the winter when he wasn't doing the circus. So Peter, our friend Peter, used to go, oh, never guess what, I won't say this fella's name, but we've just come past the tower and they're painting a big 50-foot-high picture of Norman Barrett outside with his budgies, and this fella used to get, his compere used to get the right hump, and he used to go, my dad's just never had the brakes, he's better than that Norman Barrett. And he was always on about his, and he'd go, my dad's just never had the brakes, he said, he's better than that Norman Barrett. He's got a better budgie act, you know. There was all this budgie going on. And one day, Bobby Barron, who was a wonderful fellow, he was always smoking a pipe. And he was from Yorkshire, and he just went, hasn't he got terrible budgie envy? So anyway, it all came to an end one day when another friend of ours, who was a very instrumental in Robbie's career, Carl McGrath, who lived in Southport, he come walking in the dressing room at the Carlagram, went, oh, through the local Southport newspaper on the table. This is where this fella was from. This is where this compere's dad was from. local children's entertainer use his budgie to like, he got caught, like, and put in jail for using the budgies to, like, get the children into his, like, you know, in, like, grooming them and all that. It was terrible. So the following week, we get there, and Peter, typical Peter's, comes walking in with all these bags. He's got £50 of bird seed in these bags. So he's put everywhere in this building, right, there's trails of bird seed going all over.
I've got a trill.
Trill, yeah. So there's so there's all these trails, like all along
trails the trails of trail.
Like where we used to put the ring was in this building with a on the dance floor and that. And there's all along the dance floor. There's these trails of bird seed everywhere. And so when the fella went out to announce it, like he's come in and seen all this bird seed and flipped, right. It's all lies. It's all lies. There's nothing going on. And we've managed to get the radio mic. There's two of them. And he's got one and he's talking to the audience. We're backstage and Peter's going... making as he's trying to do the bingo to the people listening, he's doing budgie noises, and this fella's flipped out and just left the building, like just run off. So that was the kind of thing that sort of went on a regular basis with us. But that's where we met, and we spent the week together.
We met at the Caligram. We've been speaking about Trill.
Oh God! So that was the week we spent a week together, and there was a lot happening that week. We got to know each other very well.
Didn't we work?
Yes.
I went back to England and to get my visa in December, and I got a good mate of mine. So like, it hasn't really been documented about me marriage and all that, but like, I split with my wife in December, so I moved all my stuff, and I've got all my stuff up in Kendal, all my artifacts and my memoirs and whatever else. And I remember Bob, like before he passed away, because like obviously he's instrumental in both of our careers. Without him, we wouldn't be sat here now.
Absolutely not.
And I don't know how I got it, but it's like typical like. Picture from the mid 80s, like a photograph, but it's like mounted on a bit of card, and I looked at it, and there's me with a mullet going like that, like a big freezing cow kipper on me face. And I'm sure you used to wear green trunks, didn't you, when you first started?
I didn't get them till after Finlay gave me them. They were a pair of Pete Roberts's trunks and knee pads, so I cherished them. I didn't get those till I was about 18.
What year was that?
That would have been 86 or something.
I swear it's you on that, because it's a picture of the Carla Grand, and Bob's sat on the stage going, you are doing.
Yeah.
And so like that particular day, I was working with Brian on a full time thing then. And
that's Brian Dixon, for anybody who doesn't know, All Star Promotions.
Wrestling Enterprise.
I was going to say, Robbie will do an impression of him at some point. There it is.
it goes together with Alan Partridge, Brian Dixon and Alan Partridge.
Brian Potter. Nearly every British wrestler can do an impression of Brian Dixon.
Yeah, but not like Robbie.
Not like Robbie's is.
Jeff Wilde was the best, really, wasn't he?
No, he wasn't. Stop. No. You've upset me. Jeff Wilde was a very good friend of mine.
Yeah,
he's was
great.
Photographer for the wrestling fraternity for a long while, and he was a real character. And all the pictures in Matt Bryan's, all the magazines were from Jeff. I don't know what happened to him. He's
he's great,
off,
Jeff.
Gone off the beaten track. but when I met Darren, Bob phoned me up and went, do you want to do a bit next week? And I went, yeah, sounds, I'd love to come back. And so I think I stayed there this one night. But I remember the last night I was there, we went back to yours. You and Chris had that flat near the town centre. And it was the young
See, lad. That's why I'm thinking it was 86 and not 85, I didn't have that flat until 86 because I got married in November of 86.
Then it was 86.
Then it was 86. Yeah. So yeah.
So would you have them trunks?
Yeah, I might have had them
trunks.
It's
like Poirot. This.
I'm just saying, piecing a crime together. Yeah. It's brilliant.
Like we are Victor and the other fellow. It was 86. I'm sure it was you on this picture.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Which makes it even more poignant to have something, you know, from, because back then we weren't encouraged to be good.
Yeah.
You know, you were really given the, what we say, Liverpool down the banks. You were given, like, you come out the ring and you'd be given abuse and told that in unceremoniously terms that you're never going to add up to nothing. And for me personally, it was like that for 3 years. And there was a couple of young lads who came in, but Darren came in the job and we just sort of, it's it. I think I worked with you the first night.
Well, we wrestled each other that week, the whole week. What we did was, Bob used to have all these different shows. And this is the infamous match that we had in front of no people, right? I'd been there wrestling, you know, for a couple of years, and I'd met Marty Jones a year before in 85, and he was sort of retraining me, but I still didn't have anybody to actually do any of the stuff with. Robbie was the first person that actually, that week, Bob put me on to wrestle Robbie every day for every show that he had, which was quite, there was some double some days, weren't there? There was afternoons and night shows. And so he'd go out and do a wrestling match, right, a competitive wrestling match. And every day, Robbie would say, right, what can you do? And I would say, I always said, I don't know anything, you know, because that's what you were told to say. And that's what I didn't think I knew anything, but I'd been wrestling for a few years. I mean, all the time, you know, when you look back, really. But I wrestled the same few fellas and they sort of had their matches down.
Yeah.
But then I'd been learning all this stuff with Marty, but I didn't really know.
It's applying it, isn't it?
It's applying it, knowing. So Robbie decided, that's why I owe him as much as anybody for anything, because that week, like, it was, right, we'll put this in round one and we can do this, and then, or just, like, letting me do things that I was learning. And all of a sudden, I felt like a different person by the end of the week. Mm. I mean, literally, it went from just, well, I'll just be a wrestler here, to, oh, there might be a future for me in this. And that was just down to him making me feel like I was a somebody by the end of the week, by letting me do these things that Marty Jones had taught me. But you say, if you've got nobody to wrestle who wants to do that stuff, or allows you to do that stuff, you can't do it. So we wrestled each other there, and then we ended up going up to Grange over Sands, and then, I don't know if we did Berwick, we think we did, didn't we? But that was the year that Bob had Filey. Mm. There used to be.
That was a separate trip, that.
Oh, was it a separate
trip?
We came back. Yeah. You came back again, didn't you?
Yeah.
I thought it was the same week, but it wasn't. No. It wasn't long after that.
No, it was like, I don't know, a couple of weeks. A month.
Okay,
a month,
right, because you came back a few times that summer, right?
Yeah.
Right, okay. But anyway, that was how we sort of got together. I thought it was the same week, but then there was a separate week, a few weeks, obviously about a month later, where we did the same thing again. And Bobby Barron, who we were just talking about, there used to be a Butlins in Filey that Robbie used to do on for Brian Dixon, and it shut down. Now, there was some business fella who thought he could just open it up.
Was his name Trevor Guy? Where did they get that name from?
He might be.
Trevor
Guy
was some entrepreneur.
Entrepreneur. He thought he was just going to open it up and people were going to come. So we went to the first week. Bob got the contract for the summer to do it. We went the first week and there was not a single person staying on the camp. Not one person had turned up. But he'd already got the show. So we went on and wrestled each other. And he says one. I always thought there was three because there was some bar people and a cleaner, and we sort of went, can you come and watch this? Because Bob said, hey, show's got to go on, we're paid, you know, like, doesn't matter if there's anybody there or not, you just do the show, right?
I've had stand-up promoters do that
right,
as well.
Right, so, and so we've got, like, a couple of the cleaners, and there's a couple of the bar staff cleaning the glasses like that, and called them over, and we wrestled a 6 5-minute round match with no falls. 30-minute match, because the other fellas wouldn't go on.
It was Ripper and Peter.
Yeah, they weren't really good.
So, like, I used to wrestle at Filey, and there'd be like 3,000 people in this ballroom. It was.
I think a lot of people don't. When you hear about the holiday camps and stuff, and people that know that do them now, a lot of American wrestlers don't understand the kind of crowd you get there, because it's a captive audience and it rains a lot. 2,000 and 3,000 people in those ballrooms watching wrestling. That's why you learn so much there. That's why Daniel Bryan and people that have come over, and Dash Wilder and stuff, that you send them over here, and they get to work the summer seasons doing that. And you've got family audiences, and you learn what makes them, what works and what doesn't. And it's a huge audience.
But that's the thing with the crowds, is every now and again, El Ligero takes a photo of every crowd that he performs in front of and puts it on Instagram. And obviously he does our shows and he does the camps and everything, and if he's in places like Minehead, and I've done stand up at Minehead when they do the Madstock, the Madness Music Festival, and it's always, I've been in that room because I've been on the stage there, and there's always tons and tons of people there whenever you go there.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you say, it's a captive audience, but a captive audience is entertaining. A captive audience is different to entertaining people who necessarily want to be there, I suppose.
Yeah. We used to have two matches back in 82, 83, 84, well, up until like when Brian got the SummerSlam or whatever it's called.
See, I wasn't around for any of that.
But he has like three and fours now. But we used to have to go in the ring and do literally 30 minutes. And go in there, go into fire. We used to go down from air on a Monday, and we get there, and we used to know this group called the Smarty Gang. Group of women. I was 16, and there was Sandy Scott, John Kenny, Mike Bennett, there was Carl McGrath. but the mainstays of the team were like Sandy Scott, and he introduced me to this group of women, and I ended up with one of these young ladies, but they were, as Sandy Scott used to call them, KP, the key personnel. So if you got to the Filey or Skegness or whatever else late, there'd be one of the key personnel would be involved in the catering. So you'd always get a sandwich or something to eat. One of them would be in the bar staff, so you'd get like a crate of beer. One of them would be in the accommodation, so you'd get a double bed. Getting a double bed back then was a huge thing. Brian used to always go, he'd always have, know the numbers with the double beds, and he'd go, right, that's mine. And I like going back to when I started, like we get to like these camps at like sometimes 2 in the morning, especially Skegness. I always remember Skegness being like particularly bad. And we get there from Scarborough doing 4 shows on the Wednesday. And we get to
see, people don't realise that. We used to, you know, I never did that many, but 4 shows. I've done 3, but it used to do 4 shows.
I wrestled once 6 times in a day.
Yeah.
And Mike Bennett, I wrestled Mike Bennett 4 times and Terry Jowett twice in one day. I mean, I'd rather do a year in prison. Like, in hindsight, thinking about it.
If you're wrestling 6 times in a day, so when I've done 2 or 3 stand-up gigs in a day, and I've done the same stuff, there's often a point where I'll get through the second or third gig. Have I said that? Is it like that we're wrestling? If you're wrestling,
but you're
in
a different place. You were moving. You were just doing 2 matches. Sometimes, the way Bobby Baron worked was, as we've talked about on this on your podcast before, 2 matches, a bit of a break, they'd have whatever, some entertainment, and then the same 4 fellas would go back in a tag.
Yeah.
Well, when I worked for Brian, I think when you, it was just 2 matches, right? Yeah. So you'd do, all down the, round the coast, there was all these camps. So you'd go and do, put the ring up, do 2 matches, drop the ring, move a few miles down the road to the next one.
Yeah.
Do it again. Down the road to the next one, do it again. And you could, you just, so it became a whatever. The difference being is with Robbie and with me to an extent is what kind of moods the older fellas were in that you were wrestling that day.
Sure.
Whether you had a good match or they just decided to stick your head up your backside or just to take it out on you to see if you had what they thought it took to stay in the business.
Mm.
And which is, you know, no need to go into any of that because people think you're making stuff up, which you're not. But
that particular week, we'd been away the week before, and we'd had a hell of a week. Brian wasn't there, so it was like having a week off, really.
Yeah.
And I was with Kashmir Singh was driving, Sandy Scott was in the front, John Kenny, Brian Maxine. I was going to say Goldbelt then, but no, I'm not going to say it. Brian Maxine. Sorry. what the hell? We're here all week, and we'd had this like tremendous week where I was actually loved the wrestling business. I thought this is for me. I was 17 and I was going through hell at the time. So I always remember coming back from Clacton, and we went back to Wolverhampton, and Jason took us to this pub. Like, it was Sandy Scott and myself, and we had to get the train back, and we had like a couple of hours to spare. And we walked into this pub, and then coming from like Northern Liverpool, I'd never saw anything like it. It was like the Red Lion in Wolverhampton, but it was just like loads of Sikh lads all having a bevy. I'd never witnessed anything like it at all. And I was like, wow. And they were like sound as a pound. The next day we got back, and we had a double show on the Saturday. We had Teesside Gala, which is up in Redcar, Middlesbrough. Or Middlesbrough, and Scunthorpe was a place called Winterton Festival. And what had happened, we had a bag called the Officials. Like, these were the spanners and like Stanley.
That's wrenches for anybody from America.
That's wrenches. All right, okay. They're just basically all the tools for the...
Yeah, just to let everybody know, the young guy on the crew was in charge. You had to put the ring up on all these shows. You were in charge of making sure that it was put up properly, and it was and when you think about a ring, these were 14-foot rings in these small shows.
So even smaller than all.
So you can put them up and down in, you know, you can put them up in less than an hour. And but the young guy's job was to make sure it was all done correctly. That was part of your apprenticeship as a wrestler. You had to do whatever was told, put the ring up, look after the ring, carry the old wrestlers' bags, polish the boots, go and get the tea, the coffee, whatever they wanted, the sandwiches. That was part of your 2-year apprenticeship.
Yeah.
And plus getting your head stuck up your backside whenever I felt like it, just to see if you had it in you to do it right. Yeah. And all the other stuff with it. But the Officials were the wrenches or spanners that you had to tighten the bolts with on the... And your job to make sure that they were always looked after. And they made a, you know, like a real production out of trying to make your life a misery, not to hide them from you or whatever. So yeah, you were panicking, so that, you know, it was just look after the Officials, right? Yeah. So anyway, that's what it is.
So there was this bag. It was like one of them old 70s bags, the sports bags that you put over your shoulder. The zip was all bust. There was no strap on it, and it was bulging with wrenches and spanners and nuts and bolts and Stanley knives, and there was a big old bell, and I had to carry this, plus I used to wrestle as Ben Truman,
King
of Beers,
yeah,
1666.
Yeah, Ben Truman used to sponsor the wrestling at Butlins when the first time I ever actually saw Robbie. When I was 15, I was already wrestling a bit at the Pleasure Beach,
yeah,
just hanging about there and doing the stuff and the challenging and that when I was a kid. I ended up going to Minehead Butlins for a week with
my... Oh, no, you didn't.
Oh, yes, I did. with my mum. because I had to go, I used to have to go and stay with my real mum had left when I was young, but I had to go and stay with her so many weeks a year. And she took me to Minehead Butlins, and I remember I was sat in the ballroom watching him put the ring up, which was Robbie, and then watching him sweep, and I was desperate to go up to him and say, look, I'm learning to be a wrestler, but I was too embarrassed, you know, because
yeah.
I thought he'd just, like, tell me to get stuffed, you know, because he seemed like a lot older. He was only 2 years older than me, but I felt like a little kid, and he seemed like... He
you do, when you're a teenager, you yeah. do feel.
And he was like a wrestler, but I remember seeing him.
I was old, and I was going through it then.
Yeah,
I aged 3 years in a week.
But I sat at the back, and I was just watching him, and I watched him put the ring up, and then I watched him wrestle, and that other... But I remember him coming out, because Ben Truman, the beer, sponsored the wrestling.
Right.
So he used to have to come out dressed as Ben Truman with an Eye Wayman's hat on. What else did you, like a cape or something?
Like a Brentford nylon, like, house coat. I used to have to give the badges to the kids. I'd come out to, like, you know, and I'm going off the sub. Tom Robinson had a big hit at the time called War Baby.
Mm.
So Brian Dixon, I don't know if it was the time you were there.
No, it wasn't. I don't remember this.
So Brian's driving one day and he said, because I was forever questioned about my sexuality by all the boys.
So you told me this just about when you were in Liverpool, just because you wanted to be a wrestler. You were saying that that was up, used to happen to you when you were a kid anyway.
Well, just like every time, like you'd be, go and get out over there. Oh, sorry. Go and get out over there. give the thing away. And if you didn't, then you battered on the other team kind of thing. And at the time, it was vital that you had to be one of the boys. I just wanted to be one of the boys. I just wanted to be accepted. And
because it's weird that it's, because wrestling is still probably less so now, but back then a very masculine industry.
Totally.
When you consider what it is. Well, the showmanship association.
There were people around that were openly open about the sexuality and whatever else. But I wasn't one. You know, I battered the stand that, and it just wanted to be. You concentrate more on being trying to be one of the lads.
Yeah.
And being accepted, you just wanted to be part of the status quo.
Yeah, people don't understand that. This may come across as bad to a lot of these older fellas, and it's not, because the way the way it was protected then, you know, there was no such thing as a wrestling school till 10 years after we were already wrestling.
Yeah,
you very rarely you couldn't get into this job unless you were an amateur wrestler, which wasn't happening. There was none where I lived. Or you went to Blackpool and you hung around at the Pleasure Beach, and Bobby Barron was kind enough to.
Even that was harder
because you got. Oh yeah, I mean it's not easy. No. You took in and you got hammered, but it was hard to get in unless your dad was in the wrestling or whatever. It was hard to get in, so you had all these older wrestlers from when you. I never had any problems when I was 15.
Mm.
When I was 15 and just going there, I was fine because I was just a kid hanging around at the wrestling and doing little bits of stuff with them and getting little bits of matches and stuff.
Yeah.
When I was 16 and I moved to Blackpool, all of a sudden, because Bobby Barron was first of all a lovely fella and would give you an apprentice, you want to come on as an apprentice.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, at the end of the day, you were cheap.
Mm.
You were getting £5 a day or £5 a job. You were taking one of the because he only needed a small crew. You were taking one of their jobs.
Yeah.
So they used to hammer you to make sure that you didn't come back.
Yeah.
They didn't want you in this business, these older wrestlers. And they used to... We tell people all the time, you ever want to see what the kind of thing that people went through? There's a match on YouTube. Watch Mike Bennett against Danny Boy Collins. And you can watch it and watch the kind of thing that happened on a daily basis to him. And, you know, it's what happened, you know what I mean? It was...
So let me just... Because I went off
in
Teesside. So I left the officials in Jason's car in this pub. And he said, leave it in Jason's car. Sandy Scott, I mean, bugger.
Yeah.
He's orchestrated this in hindsight. So I left the officials in Jason's car. So the next morning, Brian comes out the tunnel, Mitzi's in the front, Sandy Scott, Busty Keegan, and he comes out and he winds the window down. And they've been telling me about Mike Bennett for weeks and like how destructive he is.
Oh, you hadn't met him yet?
No.
All right.
No. So, and I was proper bricking it because there were people, you were in a dressing room and you knew that if you were on with them, it wasn't going to be pretty.
No.
It wasn't going to be, yeah. You know, and you
Can you just hold that thought? What I was trying to say was, if you look back at what they were doing to 16-year-old kids, which was what we were, it's bordering on child abuse, you know what I mean? If you did that nowadays, there'd be people putting you in jail for it.
Yeah.
They used to hammer you, and mental torture as well.
I could take a kick and I could take a stretch.
And I don't look bad on any of them for doing it because I understood what it was at the time. You had to earn your spot in this job because they all had to.
Yeah.
They'd all gone through it, so it was a different day and age. People don't understand that now, so sorry, that was always just...
So, we go to... Brian comes out the Mersey Tunnel and he goes, "Where's the officials?" And I'm like... I got me bag out, the back of the St George's Hall in Liverpool. He went, "It's Mike Bennett for you next week." And I went, "Oh no." And they'd been telling me about this fella. Now, I'd watched Mike Bennett at the stadium, and I just remember he's one of them people who could cause a riot in a phone box. He was brilliant, start slow, and he would absolutely tantalise people's heads.
Yeah.
So, and he went, and not only that, Terry Jowett, which is like, it's like the two dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, the pair of them, like that, just, and I didn't sleep all, and to make matters worse, we'd done the second show, it was like a carnival, and someone put itching powder in me bills. So and
ladies and gentlemen, bills are underwear.
Bill Grundy's who interviewed the Sex Pistols and got had off. But anyway,
Bill Grundy's undies.
Undies, underpants.
I was watching you explaining slang yesterday to Americans, it's one of my favourite things to watch you do.
So, coming just as a side note, we were coming back from Scunthorpe on the M62, and I'm in the back seat. What they used to call the perch in Brian's car, which is the two seats on the seven-seater
Citroen,
With they're made for kids.
I know the seats.
When you take a poodle for a walk or something like that. Well, Brian used to get three of us in the back of that.
Oh, God.
I mean, it sounds like slave labour. So I had this itching powder in my bills, and I had Mike Flash Jordan on one side, who I totally respected, and the Master of a Thousand Olds, Johnny Saint, on the other side. And I was like that. Anyway, the following week, and this is going back to the six matches in a day, we used to do Patelli on a Monday and then go up to Ayr and then do Ayr and then we'd go down to Filey and we'd do Primrose Valley. We put the ring up at Butlins, at breakfast, put the ring up, go to Primrose Valley, do that, and then for some absolutely insanic reason, Brian put a four-man knockout tournament at Butlins and at Scarborough Grand Hotel. So I was on first with Terry Jowett, and then I won that, and then go on with Mike Bennett in the final. So I'd done six matches, but I'd never worked with Mike Bennett. So we done the Monday at Patelli, and I was like doing my best to try and talk to him, and that's why, because Mike Bennett had like this like twitch kinds of thing, or like he couldn't sound his R's, so he's Brookside, Wobby Brookside. I've heard a lot about you. I can't do a Bradford accent, obviously. But he never spoke to me for like 3 days.
Yeah.
I was sat next to him in the car. I put a ring up with him. I had me breakfast, me dinner, me lunch and me dinner with him. Never said a word. And then on the morning of Butlins, he went out and bought me an ice cream. He gave me an ice cream. He went, "You're going to need that today." And what Darren just said there about the Danny Collins, when that happened, I remember like everyone was going, "It's a bloody liberty." I've been having that for 3 years. and it is the mad thing about that day. I'll never forget this as long as I've got a hole in my kyber. So you had to do three rings. I went on with Jowett, who didn't give you a sausage. He'd just give you the fall at the end. You know, like proper bury it not into the mat, into the wood.
Into the floor underneath.
Proper bury it.
This is a something else, unless you were from that time. People were only used to what they was saw on TV, which was World of Sport. They didn't expect a lot.
Mm.
So there wasn't a lot happened in a lot of the matches.
Sure.
But when you were on the receiving end of these fellas tying you up in knots and not a lot, people sat there and watched it because they just understood that was part of wrestling, right?
Mm.
But you were dying 1,000 deaths, not only, you know, like, and really getting put through it in many ways. So when people think, well, you say, well, they didn't give you anything. They didn't give you anything.
Yeah.
But fans were used to watching. If you go back and watch World of Sport, like entire shows now, there was one more of an entertainment, flashy match. There was more, you know, with more villainy in. But then there was a lot of just very straight wrestling matches where not a lot happened. And it was to give the job credibility.
Sure.
It was to give the sport of pro wrestling credibility. So people were used to seeing that kind of stuff. They don't realise you're getting your head stuck up your backside and not getting nothing. So when he says that, that's why people, it's hard for them to imagine what that was when you say you didn't get anything. You didn't get anything. Yeah. You were just tied up on the floor and getting your breath knocked out of you and like dragged about and not a lot happening, but people, that was normal wrestling at the time. Yeah. Right?
There must have been a point when you two, because if you hit it off straight away, and then you, the more, I suppose, the more regularly you guys were together, if you were, you would have been, and your respective crews, when you started working and you weren't working together, I presume you would have both been the youngest, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So,
but like for me, like when I met Darren, he was always respectful. He was always courteous and friendly, and some of the young lads who came through were like, you know, a little bit.
But it's, I think it's like that now still, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is. And like for me, for what I went through, I've just got to finish that. The bits that were left of me after Jowett and Bennett had served the cause. We went to Skegness that night after, so we put the ring down back in the cellar in the Scarborough Hotel. And Brian used to have this little Datsun, and it had two curved seats at the back, and the bit for your hands was my seat.
Yeah,
the bit for your arms. So you were like, I'm doing a hunched kind of.
So no seat back or anything, because it's not a seat.
No.
It? Yeah.
And I was exhausted. I was in pain, and you know, I was 17. And I'd gone to, like, we'd probably got about 3 miles outside of Scarborough, en route to Skegness. And the next thing, I obviously felt falling asleep with my mouth open, and they got WD-40 and sprayed the back of my throat, and I nearly vomited, like, but, and the expression, one sleeps, we all sleep, you know, and I had to apologise. And it was a hard one because I was exhausted and I was proper hurting, in pain, like me back, me the coccyx bones and me neck was killing because Mike had stretched me 4 times. Once, twice. In hindsight, that experience, that was just a Wednesday.
Yeah,
you know, I was just Wednesday. You know, we had more shows and more fish to fry, but I never look back at that experience because I would, you know, you probably heard this a few times in this conversation. I wouldn't be here now if it wasn't for that.
Yeah.
And also, it helped me, you know, because with Mike Bennett, I was very shy and timid, with, you know, to start with in wrestling, because you were too scared to take things.
Yeah,
but with him, after about a month of being on with him, it was a case of like, well, I'm going to have to take it here. And I learned to snatch things. And I learned, you know, when you take a leg, when you do a single leg, it's not a tease dance or anything like that. You've got to freaking get it.
Yeah.
You know, and he helped me in a indirect way of learning how to snatch things. And the fact that we're talking about, you know, we play, Terry Taylor's a fellow coach and a hell of a fella back in Orlando, and I played that to Mike Bennett, and because I thought I wonder if there's any stuff from Mike Bennett, because we don't have any videos of, yeah, like early. We've got a couple of like grainy footage, black. There's even the black and white one of you and I.
Yeah.
Ironically,
and the hundreds of matches that me and you had against each other, and there were some pretty, you know, we sort of set a standard at that time for quality, like. Yeah.
I remember you saying the last time I interviewed you, you guys would really go for it because you had the opportunity to.
And we, you know, we did some incredible stuff together, you know, and that's, I don't usually say a lot about this.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's funny because we're going to Brighton today.
Yeah, I was just
going
to say, yeah.
And my favourite match of all time was June the 6th, 1990 against Robbie in Brighton. Mm. And we got a first time ever, that you'd never heard of this stuff in those days. Me and him wrestled each other, and there was a lot of old wrestlers in there, and we got a standing ovation for a competitive wrestling match, and I mean a proper standing ovation. And but anyway, all these matches that mean there's only one survives, and it's probably the worst one we ever had.
It was after I had longer.
And I'd been at, for whatever reason, I'd got to my parents' house. Was it Leicester?
No, it was the black and white one, I think, is Bristol.
Wherever it was, I'd been to my parents' house on the afternoon, and I'd gone out with my cousin, and we ended up, he said, let's have something to eat, so we had a load of food, and then I got back to my mum, you know, my stepmom had done me like steak and chips or something like that, and then I went, and like I was just like all stuffed him. I think we had to go on first or something instead. I just remember being not like oh. And we had like a usual 6-5 minute round match, you know. And it was just wasn't, to me it wasn't. I remember it not being the kind of as good as we used to be.
Was you in America then?
It was years before.
I remember we used to do American air bases.
Oh yeah.
And they were particularly hard.
Yeah.
Like just all these American...
That was like the American air bases in England, right?
Yeah.
So I suppose you're doing a more British style of wrestling in front of Americans, yeah, who were used to a different style.
Yeah. Well, it was just paid entertainment for them, you know. So we used to go on, and they just couldn't care less about all the other stuff.
Mm.
And me and him used to wrestle each other, and then within half a round of the first round, they'd start watching. by round two and three, they were throwing money on the table, betting on each other who was going to win. And that was like really the some of the proudest things we ever did.
That was
did,
the only time of all the times I did the camp, those camps.
What happened to that girl you were knocking off that used to be the over the head of that shoes?
That was the night.
She had a right old Kitty. Sports car. Yeah. Kitty.
She's like a Kitty.
Kitty. She was like the head of the whatever it was.
Yeah, she was a sergeant.
He was like 20 years old driving around in a Porsche with her or something. Like
She came to Norwich. And like there's like tractors.
That's not the city, by the way. That was the wrestling building. Yeah. We used to wrestle the Corn Exchange. The Corn Exchange. We used to wrestle in the cattle market.
It smelt of cow pee. Yeah. And she turned up and picked me up. I felt like the Duke of Norfolk. but some of the mad places that Brian used to take.
Linlithgow. There was a show.
Where's Linlithgow? Scotland. So we used to go up to this place,
and it was a Rotary Club do, and they wanted strippers and a blue Comic Con, but they had for wrestling for some. They had no interest whatsoever. But again, me and him have gone on there and had them throwing money, betting who was going to win, throwing wads of cash on the table, because we just used to be able to draw people in.
And you've given people such a competitive match that they just didn't know.
And in those days as well, I always describe like a wrestling match, because people don't really want to watch, you know, especially too young. Like, I mean, if there's loads of cougars in the audience and whatever else, then maybe, but not fellas who've got like, a chain of hotels and whatever else, and you have to go through the first round, and you have to be committed to what you're doing, and you have to believe in what you're doing. And once you get through the first round, it's almost like going through like a mini desert. But there will be an oasis if you're both strict and you both understand what you're doing, and you both work together. Because a wrestling match is a lost art. You know, there's nobody now, I don't say nobody, but and it really serves a purpose on any card or whatever you
call it. It was that thing of, there was always one of those matches on a British bill in those days to give credibility to everything else.
Yeah.
And they would even say like, okay, well, we know this isn't, and people, we know this isn't going to be the most exciting of things, but it will give credibility. But we got to a point where we were like getting major like reactions from doing them when you weren't expected, because we both had the same mentality of going out and like making this look as good as possible, and like chasing, like, you know, I'd chase after his leg and he'd chase after my arm, and it would just be backwards and forwards and up and down. So we're getting off the point a lot here because we should be talking about the two of us as what we were, right?
No, but I just want to say something there. For people who have never wrestled before and listened to this and whatever else, it's a mad thing. Like, I remember, obviously, when we started wrestling and we had it off all over Britain. But, like, he was with Chris. And he'd get up in the morning and go to the gym. I live with my ma, and I'd get up, go to the gym, do our thing. He'd come from Blackpool, I'd come from Liverpool, we'd get in the car, we'd go to wherever, and we'd just dial in and Robbie. And we'd get to a show, and you put your gear on, you warm up, you get in, and all of a sudden, once you step into that ring, it's another world. And it's a place that, yeah, you do miss it now, you know. I'd be lying if I said that I do miss, and I look at it and I think, I'd love to go on with him, and I'd love to, but you have to say that's gone. But at this moment in my life, when I stepped in the ring, no one could touch me, and no one could touch him. We'd go in the ring, and it was a very, very special place. And unfortunately, we don't have video evidence of this.
You've still got that, Matt. When you go home this week, is that match we had an hour match at the power plant
in front of the trainees. Paul Douglas,
okay,
the lad from Hull.
He came over to America at one point to film some stuff for that video diaries.
Yes,
thing he did.
So
we were at the original power plant in Atlanta. We went down. It was red hot, wasn't it? And we just started, and we ended up doing an hour. I think DDP was referee.
He stopped the match and said, "Hey, can I get?" We were speaking about that, didn't we? And at Access, and he said, "Do you remember that match you done with that?" And he was always lovely. Dallas was always a lovely
fella.
And he got in the ring. But you said to me, because when you first went, we were still in touch and whatever, and he phoned me up, he said, "It's not what I thought it'd be, you know, I can't work it out." But he did.
Yeah.
And he went like that, I got this video diary thing, Brian, went, there you go, have that. And then basically just dumped it on us. And at the time, it was always his thing to go to America, Darren, My dream was to get wrestling back on TV.
Yeah.
That was the day he came off, we were in Victoria, and Rocco went and bought the papers, and he came back. He said, "Well, that's it, we're done." And a little bit of my heart broke that day. And so it was always that was my thing. So when we'd done the video diaries, there's a guy called Bob Talpert at the BBC. I mean, he was the producer. And so he was really good. He used to come down. And at the time, I was living in Kent. And Darren had gone there. So he went like that. "Well, you know, should we go out and look at what Darren's doing?" And I'm like, "Yeah, great."
Yeah.
So they paid for me to go out. And so when I went out, I stayed with Darren and saw the boys, you know, with Chris and whatever else. And he went, "Let's go to the power plant. Let's show them what the rest." So we just started wrestling. And he went, put an hour on the clock. He never liked me ever since the Carlin Grand. I knew then that was the moment when I thought, "Oh, here we go." And we just... I mean, we didn't call anything, you know. We didn't, you know, sit down, and we have this. Can we come from an era when it was wrestling?
Mm.
There was no. It was just wrestling. You got in the ring and you worked and you wrestled. So there's a lot of expressions for wrestling now, like chain and all this garbage. You know, it's we
wrestling's wrestling.
Yeah. And so we got in the rings, and there was like three rings in the power plant, and they were doing things with dolls and dummies and stuff like that. And Blackjack was there as well. Blackjack Mulligan, that's the soul. And all of a sudden, everyone stopped, and then they were all around the ring, and I remember the last kind of. And this is where you get people when you do a wrestling match. Last 10 minutes, people were like, come on, Regal, come on, Brookside.
Mm.
And these are the people that are employed by WCW as the next generation of wrestling. And I think with 20 minutes to go, Dallas got in the ring, so can I referee this?
Mm.
And I mean, we were proper both spent at the end of it.
You would be, it's an hour.
Cream crack. And it was hot. Yeah. You know, there was no ventilation or anything like that. And that was, you know, it is on video somewhere.
Yeah, it is.
You need to get it and put it out.
No, actually, thinking about it, might be a right load of old cobbles.
You speak for yourself.
Is that the last time you would have wrestled each other?
No. We actually... Right, so this is so in 2000 I went back to the WWE.
Yes.
And I got sent to Memphis. There is a myth out there that I had a match with Chris at the Brian Pillman show that got me back to the WWE. That is not the truth. I was already employed by the WWE. I was in Memphis.
Still a very good match, by the way.
Yeah. 6 months. Jim Ross had said, you'll go there for 6 months and then you will start on the main roster as long as there's no problems. I was there exactly 6 months and then started on the main roster.
Yeah.
And anybody who thinks that that match caused that, they seem to forget that they were seeing all my stuff from the TV show in Memphis and everything. But
of course,
it's become somewhat of a myth. Anyway, Robbie came over because he was going to somewhere. He was going to Japan.
No, there was no tournaments in Germany.
Okay.
And you called and said, look, come over.
Right, that was it, yeah.
Come over and, you know, he's never promised me anything. Mm. You know, like, our friendship is the most important thing. He's helped me like no other, you know. Mm. And again, the reason why I'm sat here now is because of him. And, like, we went to Memphis and I remember we stayed in Terry Golden's. And we shared a double bed.
Top and tail.
And we listened to the governor's life story every night on the audio book.
And anyway, before I'm going to have to. So one day we were in Memphis. It ended up us having a match anyway. There's some great footage from there. Teddy, we could do again.
Never saw any of that.
Well, no, but there's like Daniel Bryan, Spanky, you know, the Reckless Youth was there and all. There was a hell of a crew
Lance.
There.
Oh, poor Lance.
Yeah, and Lance, and there was like a hell of a crew there, you know, and we were doing some really good stuff. But we did a show at Dixieland, how bad's that? They're like the amusement park there in Memphis, which is by the Coliseum. And we did a show there, and it was outside. It was
three days.
Yeah, something like that.
Or three shows.
One day we wrestled each other there, right? And that was the last time we would have wrestled each other. Mm. But anyway, so we're in Memphis one day, and I said, "Well, we're both here. We got a day off." Oh. we've got to go to Graceland's, right? You know. So we go to. And we don't realise it's Elvis week. It's the anniversary of when he passed away, right? So we get there and it's packed. Right? It's packed. So it was, they give you a little, it was a Walkman at the time with a tape in and the headphones, and walking around, and it's Priscilla Presley's voice going, "Well, this is the room." And you know, when you get inside, it's a bit suspect, isn't it? It's like really dodgy. Everything's not what you think it's going to be in there. It's all a bit like, ooh, it's all a bit tacky and everything.
Yeah.
But she's going, we're walking from room to room and we're just laughing because Priscilla Presley's talking in her ears going, "Well, this is the room where Elvis and she was doing it like that. "Well, he was funny. He used to stay in here he was in here for 6 months once and never come out." And we're like, you know, like, as if that was normal, you know. And then you walk through the kitchen and Elvis, he loved his food. For 6 months, we had the exact same meals every day, meatloaf and potatoes and Oh, it was funny. And I'm thinking, and we were both picking one ear off the thing, looking at Zenovich's, thinking, the bleeding lunatic, you know. So we're having a running commentary, just like making ourselves laugh, walking through. So we get outside and the grave's there and it's just covered in flowers and there's all these people there and they're all upset and everything. Because, we, you know, it's the big week for them. Yeah, so we walk up and it's very sad, you know, you're looking at it, and it's a big deal, right? So we're both looking at this grave, and all of a sudden, this young fella who's dressed like Elvis, but young Elvis, he's got the tight jeans on and the shirt and the cigarettes in the up his sleeve and in his short thing and the quiff and everything. He walks in front of us, drops to his knees, and goes, and I went, just started laughing like just. And he just run off and left me.
I was in the stables.
And everybody, there was all these old women, and they all just turned around and like looked at me like I just dropped out of a dog's backside, you know, like they were just staring holes from me, and I was like, and I looked, and he'd run away. He just left me. So they're all like just glaring at me, and I'm still laughing because I'm like, and this fella's like bawling tears, like he's So we better get out of here because they were all like, there's like, there's going to be a mob come after us or something. All these old ladies and that. So we get out the gates And we go across the street. There's like a big marquee, like a big tent.
Yeah.
And we go in, and there's all these chairs sitting on. There's about six people in. And there's an Elvis impersonator on the stage, like the big fat Elvis, though, right?
Yeah.
And he's singing away to a, he's got his karaoke machine on. Now, there's about four people at the front, obviously his family. And then there's me and him sat at the back. And then another two, then there's another fella dressed as Elvis, fat Elvis, with a jumpsuit, and his wife sat next to him, like, in the end. And so we're just sat there like, this can't be happening, you know, this is, it's all a bit sad, you know. So this fella's gone, he's finished his song, and he weren't very good anyway, you know. Obviously the good people go on at night.
Yeah.
This is where they did all the Elvis impersonations, all week. And this fella said, actually, ladies and gentlemen, and he's trying to turn his tape over, because it was in the days of tapes, and he can't get it in. So he's like, he's got to fill some time now, right, in between songs. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not actually from Memphis. I'm from Paducah, Kentucky. You know Paducah? That's what it sounds like when you eat too much. Paducah. And I went, again, I went, oh! It's like, did the worst phoniest horse laughing. And he just got up and left me again, just buggered off and left me. Sat there.
I'll take him anywhere.
Yeah, so we bailed off out of that. Anyway, though, that was the last time we ever wrestled each other, was in Memphis. I've got to say this, we were talking about being on the... We get back to the beginning, right, because we keep going off in these tangents. So we did this week together, then we did this other week together, and it was at the right at that same time period is when I started working for Joint Promotions, Big Daddy's Brothers firm. Robbie worked for Brian Dixon. I worked for them for a few months and then and quit.
We talked about that last time before.
I got put in the Big Daddy tags and I thought now I had some hope because of what Marty Jones had taught me and what Robbie had showed me that was a possibility that I could actually do.
Yeah.
That was just a few weeks wrestling him had given me a complete different outlook on this business. So I owe him everything, really, because if I hadn't have had that, I don't know where I'd have got to, you know.
Yeah.
So it was like, oh, there's light at the end of the tunnel here. But then, oh, well, I want to be one of them international wrestlers that travels to Germany. And it was all sort of coming at... But I got put in the Big Daddy tags, and it was, I'm never going to get any better now, because all I'm going to do is get beaten up and do the selling and then tag Daddy in.
Yeah.
And everybody thought that's a great spot to have, but I wasn't... Now I'd seen that I could actually learn this wrestling stuff that I've been... being taught and not being able to do. So I ended up quitting and going to work for Brian Dixon, which was November of 1986. I know Robbie had already talked to him. Frank Cullen,
I remember the Talbot Road bus station. Yeah,
right.
Because I stayed at your house
the
last night, and I said, you were talking about being in the Daddy Tags, and I said, go and work for Brian, because you work for different people. You work with different people every night,
and you're only going to get better.
And
you work with Steve Gray one night, and Dave Taylor or Terry Rudge or Pete Roberts, Johnny Saint, you know, and you're
just around all them fellas, because they weren't that them kind of fellas weren't working for Joint Promotions anymore.
And even being around people makes you absorb
the knowledge, and that's what I wanted, right? So. I'd spoke to Frank Cullen at Blackpool Tower one night, and he said, well, call Brian tomorrow, I'll talk to him. Robbie had already talked to him for me. I called Brian up, and like I've told you that story, he's, are you mental? You know, you're already on TV. What do you want to... I said, because I want to get better. And like whatever anybody wants to say about Brian, I've got not a bad word about him, because he said to me, I promise you, I'll put you on with somebody better than you every night.
Yep.
And he always did. And from my first night with him was at Cheltenham. You were there, and Liger was there. It was when he was flying Fuji Yamada. And I was on with Rocky Moran the first night. And then within, I honestly don't know when it happened, but within an incredibly short period of time, he put me together with you as a tag. So that's when we became a tag team as the Golden Boys. Because I'm not number one Golden Boy. I don't know if you know that. He did have another partner that he... but you did though. The original Golden Boys was Robbie Brookside and Wayne Martin.
No, we were the young ones.
Oh, you were the young ones.
And there was another fella called Barnacle Bill.
Oh.
I mean, that's a good young one name, isn't it?
No, he was riddled in it with acne. So, and that's...
Barnacle Bill.
His name was Lee Roberts. Spindly little boy from Northampton or somewhere, Oundle or some one of these places.
How did these people get in the job?
Yeah, like, he was one of Blondie Barrett's lads, and he was covered. Yeah. And at the time, and I might put some people off here, but like the heel team used to take a fall on him, so he'd be like laying gay abandoned, and I couldn't stop myself. And be popping all these like blackheads on his back, had like proper big black and like curly whirlies and oh god, so I tagged with him for about a month, but he wasn't very good.
I can say because he's a footnote in history, isn't he? And then Wayne Martin.
Martin was the.
Did you chin him or something once?
Yeah, so yeah. We were.
End of team.
I beat him up. Yeah, no. We were in Hastings at the White Rock Theatre. And and so some of the people, some of my peers who I look up to, even to this day, John Cortez and Keith Haywood, and we're at the back, and Terry Rudge was in the ring, and Wayne Martin was, had like some older woman, I think he married her, actually. Anyway, so Wayne had probably 4 years in the job, and he thought he was a veteran status and whatever else. Yeah. And he's talking to his future wife, and he went, "Look at this owl, such and such for Terry Rudge." So Cortez,
who was of course tremendously respected.
Oh, I mean, there's no superlatives that when we talk about Terry Rudge. I mean, the fella was even now, I was a lot better person and wrestler for knowing him and going on with him. But to say that about, in front of people. Mm. So they came in and they said, "Look, it's on you now. You got it." I was on with them that night at these things. So he never came back in the job anyway.
Yeah.
So, that was bestowed on me.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And we got put together as a team. And then, it was pretty short order after that. And we were... So I was either tagging with Robbie, I was either wrestling Robbie, or I was wrestling whoever else, which was great, And that was the difference maker in my career, was just being around him and being around the right people. And it's all timing, at the end of the day, it was being born at the right time that we both came in this job at the right time, when there was the older wrestlers that could teach you how to do this in a different skill level.
We were very lucky we're going to see three of them tonight,
like Mal Sanders and Steve Gray and Lee Bronson are coming to the show.
Oh, brilliant.
But just being around these fellas that were full time old pros that knew every trick in the book, and just being around them and watching them, and so we were the last of that sort of people that ever came along that got to do that. And it's just time. It's no good going, all these young fellas. No, it's not their fault. Mm. They haven't got the capability. That's why we're very open to helping everybody, because it's not their fault. Mm. You can't say, well, these fellas, like, you get that old wrestler thing. Well, back in my day, it was different then, because we got to work six nights a week, and everybody that's from the old seems to forget that they weren't very good at one point.
Yeah,
and they slowly got better because they wrestled five and six and seven nights a week.
Yeah.
With better people.
Yeah.
And so it's very hard for people nowadays, But anyway, we got put together, and we were basically doing a stuff. The following year, 87, that was my first year on the Butlins camps for Brian. Right. Now, basically, for 20 weeks, because that used to be a 20-week run, right?
So presumably the summer season.
The summer season. Well, now it's 6 weeks, right? But 20 straight weeks, we would pick me up at Preston at the Tickle Trout on a Sunday morning.
Or Blackpool underneath the bridge.
Right at the end of the M55, onto the M6. So, excuse me. And we'd go up to Ayr, do a Sunday afternoon show at Ayr, jump straight in the car, drive to Skegness, which was 6 hours.
Oh, that's a long
10 hours in a day. 10 hours.
10 hours in the day. So, but the drive, we, everything was and like it was Brian Dixon driving because he refereed.
Yeah.
Myself, Robbie, Doc Dean, and a another, and that was the crew. Every week there was a rotating fourth person.
Yeah.
Which was magic most of the time because there were some great people that came along and added to the. Because they just at those days, Butlins just used to be two matches.
Sure.
And then we also used to, Brian Dixon, they were always afternoon shows, and then for the Butlins and Brian Dixon used to have, like, when all the seaside resorts were running, he used to have, like, what we called town shows,
yeah,
which were Eastbourne, Clacton, Hastings, Worthing, and then he also had a spare, like, one Selsey, like a caravan park, yeah, on a Thursday.
That was Thursday afternoon.
Thursday afternoon. So we used to go up to Skegness, go up to Ayr, drive to Skegness. On that trip to Skegness every week, there was the 6 hour drive, there was Barry White's greatest hits, George Formby's greatest hits,
Frank Sinatra.
So these, like, sort of, they were
sing-alongs
all the way, you know, yeah, and different silly things that we used to do. Get there at like 2 o'clock in the morning, do the show there in the afternoon, then drive from Skegness on a Monday afternoon down to Bognor Regis to do a town show there because he used to run Bognor. Mm. Then go across and stay at Bognor Regis Butlins,
yep,
do the show there Tuesday afternoon, double back to whatever show we were doing, which would be Worthing or whatever, one of them shows, go from there, shoot across to Minehead, which was getting to Minehead about 5 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Get up, the show was always at
12 o'clock,
yeah, but you'd have to do the ring at 9, wouldn't you?
You'd have your breakfast, which went through you like a Porsche.
Oh, yeah.
as soon as you had Butlins breakfast, and we used to, I mean, some of the stuff that we used to do, you know, as in-house entertainment.
So,
and I don't know how it started, the water, but yeah. The unfortunate person who'd come, like, just, they used to go, we'd start putting the ring up and they go, I have to go for a Tom, which is a number two for those people. I won't give up the cockney backside. So they'd go to the toilet and Brian would have this like big smirk on his face and he'd go, and the big long bars in Butlins, big long, I forget what it was, Princess Ballroom or whatever it was called, and they'd have like a load of the pints at the ends with like stale ale and such. So we'd all run in, so there'd be four of us, and we'd quietly open the tap and fill like two pint pots each, and we'd all go together at once. One, two, three,
whoosh over the top of the toilet.
And we'd done everyone. Everyone. It was like a sort of welcome to Butlins. But there was a wrestler called Alan Kilby who was deaf, and he was. I always liked Kilby. He was always. Some people didn't like him, but I always got on well, and I was. You had to get stuck into him, kind of thing. It was terrible in a rumble when he wasn't going over because he'd just stay into the end. So you had to get like five of you to get him. It's time for him to go here, lads. Come on. I know you're a heel. Come on. But I don't care. Yeah, go on. Do one. So anyway, he goes for a number two. So Dixon there. Come on. Let's have. And the night before, he'd gone asleep. He was deaf. He'd fallen asleep with the television on like 48.
Yeah.
And the security were knocking on the door and he went to Brian. There was a big, big palaver about it and whatever else. And Brian went, come on and get him. So we all ran in and we all got the cold water and we whoosh. And you just said, it's a miracle. And he came out and he had a pair of like sky blue tracksuit bottoms on. He came out and he was like walking down. So but
I'd turn up at press. Oh, and sorry, you do Minehead.
Yeah.
Then you double back and do another thing like Worthing or something, like all the way back to the south. And then do Selsey on a Thursday afternoon, then you go up to Pathelli, do Pathelli.
Hang on, I think you go Selsey to Worthing and Worthing
to Pathelli.
Oh, it's miserable.
And getting there at about 6 o'clock in the morning on a Friday.
No electric, and we used to get these chalets with the 50 pence.
Oh, yeah.
We were all that, you know, with, fuck, oh, I'm not putting 50 pence in there. Because 50 pence was a bit more than what it is now.
Yeah.
There was no sheets on the bed.
Yeah.
Oh,
I get there, get up, do the ring, and then I go back to Blackpool that night. I'd do the Pleasure Beach on a Saturday,
yep.
And then we'd start again Sunday. And so
2,000 miles
a week like that, and it was. But anyway, sometimes you'd turn up, and it was always this revolving. We'd mentioned him before, but the Dragon Sandy Scott was a Scottish wrestler who had pretty much retired by then and had a regular job and got married and that.
He moved to like
Lowestoft, something like that.
Beckles.
But he used to be a full time. They used to call him the King of the Camps, right? Because he did it for years, and he had it all figured out, and he was just hysterical, just really, really funny. Like breakfast on a morning, you're all bleary eyed, and there'd be all the families there, you know, the people staying in the camp. And he'd, every morning the same thing, but he was always funny. He'd walk in. And he'd go, drum roll, please. And he'd grab one of the tablecloths with some family sat there. And
no, like he was no, gonna, Sandy, no.
No, Sandy, don't do it, don't do it. Come on, like he was going to whip the tablecloth. And people scattering and just stupid. One night we get to Bognor Regis. And this is all tied into wrestling. We get there and we hadn't got the show that night for some reason. The town show wasn't on. So we just went straight to the camp. And we got there, and it was that fella that he was the entertainer. He was the. When Kendo Nagasaki unmasked in
1970. Oh, Tony Sweet.
Tony Sweet. Well, I was there. I was in the audience as a child watching.
Did not
that.
Know that?
Yes.
With a big tattoo on his head?
Yes, it was at Wolverhampton Civic Hall, and that was my local, and I was there when that happened, right? So, we get to the. And this fella comes over, Tony, and he said to the Dragon was there, Sandy Scott, and the Dragon liked to. Drink a few. He said, he started telling us about he did the thing with Nagasaki. He was one of the guys that was stood in the corner with the shaved heads and all that. Well, now he's the entertainments fella there. And I believe you can drink a bit. And Dragon said, I can drink a few. 7 o'clock this. By 9 o'clock, this fella who's supposed to be in charge of the entertainment there in a full bar. Is the manager of this thing. He stood on the bar with his tadger out, dipping it in his own pint of beer, like singing song, you know, like, I mean, absolutely blathered this fella, you know, just completely done him in. And we just thought that was the kind of stuff that went on a regular basis, you know. It was just nuts.
Someone to look up to.
Someone to look up to, yeah. We were wrestling each other all the time. We were tagging together all the time, and we did the infamous the unmasking thing with Nagasaki and that on TV. That was one of the last ever TV shows, really.
It was Brian's last one.
Yeah.
Is this the hypnosis?
The hypnosis thing. Yeah. He's never got over it. Yeah.
Because I remember the first time I met Robbie. Was before I'd met you, and because you came in when I was a radio presenter in Leicester, when you were living in Leicester, and I nearly got me fired, as I always tell people. The interview was meant to be 10 minutes, and we just end up talking for 40 minutes because I wanted to know about Germany.
Banging
and
on the windows, and they've got, hey! We made it all the way, Bob's.
But, because I remember asking you about that then, because it's a weird thing to have had on telly at the best of times, because it's still quite, it's dead famous, isn't it?
He ate it, right?
Mm. No, do you know what I've come to appreciate?
It's one of the most memorable things of my childhood.
I've come to appreciate how much respect he had for this industry and for keeping the jobs. The way it was and the mystique that he had.
Yeah.
And at the time, there was no secret that I didn't really, and I've never really said this before, but me and him didn't get on.
Right.
for a few reasons.
This is Nagasaki, not me.
And we didn't get
This is a newsflash to Robbie, if it was him.
We didn't get on, and there's, you know, and the few people that are around at that time know that, and know that, you know, I wouldn't put up with any of his nonsense.
Because I've read things about him, and he was an odd dude, wasn't he?
Right, so, but now that I've come to appreciate, at the time I didn't, but it didn't take me long to figure out, once I was away from that, how incredibly dedicated to his craft he is.
Absolutely.
Which I think is absolutely, now I think was absolutely, doesn't matter what he is, it was fantastic.
Yes.
That he still has that mystique to this day.
Of course.
And people, so the lengths that he would go to protect the image and the professionalism that he showed by doing that is something to be admired. That being said,
he gives and he takes away.
Taketh away. That whole thing was just like me being, luckily it was me on the apron and not having to do what he did, and I wouldn't have done it anyway, was holding me up to Robbie for being able to do it. But me, this poor lad sat here looking over at me, and me just had my head buried in my arms.
the first time we did it was in Ipswich.
See, I can't remember that.
The first time we did it, so.
So you did it all, because obviously it's in the televisor, but I didn't realise you'd done it more than once.
We'd done
it first time in Ipswich. And then after the thing, I mean, and like, you were going off on your jollies then, but I've had some of the most powerful reactions I ever had.
Oh, yeah.
He used to do me.
Yeah.
Not literally, that'd be hideous. But he used to do me and take me out in the car. This is as well as Nagasaki, I'm putting myself over here now, because I'd go to the show with Brian. So he'd hypnotise me and take me out and get in the car. He'd had Lawrence driving the car. I remember one night at Bristol, the back of the Colston Hall, and he threw me into the car and drove off, and there was girls screaming like, what have you done to him? And he dragged me up on the M5 and dropped me off at the services. I'd get out and have this like pair of lycra and a thong up with Jaxie. I'd have to walk into the bloody service station, walk into the toilets. Now you can imagine the toilets at the time.
Yeah.
I'd have to go in the bog and get changed and then wait for Brian, and I wouldn't have... I'd wash me.
Brian, I don't know, but I would imagine Brian was in no rush to come and get
you. Yeah, exactly. Didn't he stop for kebabs and chucky fried chicken and all that? And then, like, there was probably about 6 months of that where, it wasn't every night, but,
yeah,
you know, some of the bigger shows, like Crow.
Right after we did that thing on TV, that's when my career took off. Saw us travelling. I went to... That summer I went to France on and off for 6 weeks, and then I went to Germany for the first time, to Hamburg that year, and then I never looked back for the next 4 years until I went to America. I was just away all the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wasn't involved in any of that. There was just a couple of things that I was around, like there was a bit of a kerfuffle one night with... me and Pat Roach, it wasn't you, it was me and Pat Roach at Southampton, on with him, and we had a bit of a falling out, and I won't go into too much detail, but, like, you know, we didn't get on, let's put it that way. He didn't like me and I didn't like him, and I was quite happy to sort it out with him, and it sort of, I think it was just...
There was always a lot of kerfuffles with him.
But like, I just wouldn't, you know, it didn't bother me at all, and I'm quite happy to go on, you know. And then there was a few times when it was, let's go out and sort this out, you know.
Did some of that come from, you know, with how you were treated when you were 15, 16? I suppose the older you get, the more likely you are to sort of stand up, especially when you've got more comfortable and you've had Robbie around you and stuff. Like, you're going to be more comfortable.
I think a lot of it was going to work in nightclubs when I was 17 and just realising... Yeah. What's the worst that can happen to me?
Yeah, but also you got to stand up for yourself.
Yeah, but you know, like, just what's the worst that can possibly happen to me?
Yeah,
you beat me up or kill me, I'm not frightened of either. So it's not about. I don't care. I don't think I've ever. I've never thought I'm anything at all, but I'm just not frightened. Why would I beat me upside with him? We've had that many hammerings in this job. What's the worst that anybody can do to you? When you're 16, you're getting hammered on a regular basis, and I mean twice a day sometimes, yeah. And going off. I'll be the first to admit, going off when you're 16, locking yourself in a toilet and crying and coughing blood up and crying. Mm. And thinking, when's this ever going to end, right? I mean, regular basis.
Bus stops and train stations.
Yeah, yeah, and just, like, what can anybody do to... And then getting in, working in the club job when I was such a young age and seeing all kinds of horror stuff going on, real fights and people getting all kinds of happening and being around Blackpool and that. Well, what's the worst that anybody can do to me?
Yeah.
I'm not buying into all this. And then there's another tale, this I'm not going to tell on here, but... Robbie knows it, of something happened in Blackpool with him that, like a lad we know, ended up giving him a bit of a good hiding. And once I found that out, I thought, well, this fella couldn't fight sleep. So it's not like... Do you remember that?
Who was that?
That the lad at the car, this car thing. There was that mate, you know, the one that got blown up? Remember that, like, mate of Peter's, and he ended up having a bit of a do with him and did him in at his car place in Blackpool.
Oh, him, yeah.
Same lad.
Oh, right.
So this fella had done him in.
I thought you were about me getting...
No.
I don't recall this.
I'm trying to be vague, but that a fella that our friend who we told about before, Peter, a mate of his, had a fallout with him and given him a bit of a, and then once I found that out, and I was only 18 when I found that out, it was like all the mystique was gone.
Yeah.
And then that fella got blowed up, remember?
But Kellett always put him over.
Yeah,
on,
yeah.
Kellett on that, whatever the doc.
Yeah, but don't forget, these fellas were...
I think in his day, I think...
Of course he was,
I think
yeah.
He was like...
But don't forget, I was also 6'3" and 18 stone and like... It's not that I'm any good at anything. I'm just not frightened. Not frightened of anybody. So
there comes a time when we
butted heads. Yeah, and it was. I have the utmost admiration for what he did and the thing. But it was. It just. You know, I've seen him once since then. Was 1996, because I came back for a few weeks and did a. Brian asked me to do a few shows, and I did Croydon. Yeah, it was on me and you.
Right.
And he'd come in the dressing room, he'd come to see Marty over something, and we had a nice chat and everything. Yeah. And that, it was just, at the time, I just, you know, I don't, from what happened to me and him, I just don't like liberty takers. Mm. And he tried to take a liberty with me once, and I stopped it.
Kick the bell.
Yeah, and it was like, I stopped
it's
it.
It's impossible, I'm not an octopus.
And then I just went... No, that's not in anymore, you know. Yeah. And that was like, ooh, everybody was like, ooh.
Yeah.
And Dave Taylor will go into great detail about an episode that happened at Cheltenham once where, like, let's forget about that.
Cause I've got a good one in Stockport.
Yeah.
When it kicked off the dock.
Yeah.
I ended up getting copping for that one because I was, like, kind of a shop steward at the time. And it got. I don't know. You just get tested sometimes when you for your love for this job, and it kicked off. Cut the long story short, he slammed the doc on the stage, and
Doc Dean,
who became me kind of last tag partner. But he was at the time the doc was doc could he could go like, but he was. He wasn't the sharpest on the block, that should be said.
Like, he grew up, had a terrible upbringing, yeah. And so he wasn't scared of, you know, he wasn't frightened of anything, like, you just, like again, what can you, what, he had,
what's the worst that can
what
happen?
That's the worst that can happen to you, and there was a lot of that went on, and...
We could get to the meet early, Doc.
It's like, and it was a lot of things, there was a point when it was, I was ready to... And then I looked at him one day and I thought, hang on a minute, I'm 20, he's 45, he's not moving so well, he's got... And I thought, it'd be a liberty to give him a good eye.
The opposite has then applied, hasn't
it? Yeah, and I thought it'd be a liberty to give him a good eye, didn't it? But
I have to, like, what I've got to second what you just said there. When you first work with him and all that, you're in awe of him. towards the latter stages, I have to say, Doc and I kept his career together, you know, because we worked for him,
yeah,
and still were able to get to do our stuff. But is the way he went about things, you can't knock, and the way he kept himself,
absolutely,
you know, it was actually,
and still to this day, yeah. I mean, incredible. Yeah. I have great admiration for that. You know, that the mystique that he's kept, and to keep the strength of the job the way he has. And,
he wouldn't take the mask off. And I know, the Mexican lads have their kind of thing, but he was one, he was in England, and he'd keep the mask on. Even, like, people used to get annoyed because if he spoke to you, which was a rarity, a lot of people, but it was kind of, you look at him and you go, well, yeah, you know, he taught me a lot about keeping it, you know, the dressing room is sacred,
yeah,
you know, and he would never be seen. he travelled on his own,
yeah,
and he most of the time he got what he wanted and whatever else, but, you know, he was around for a long time, and he was a huge name back in the 60s and the 70s and whatever. But I took a few leaves out of his book, and
for whatever.
Can I tell the story about Clapham South Station?
You might want to leave that one.
Tell me afterwards, mate.
Yeah.
So tell me afterwards.
Just to let you know, ladies and gentlemen, we've had to have a discussion before we started this. You may have been expecting far more than you're getting, but. We decided that we had to leave an incredible amount of our life spent together out to save us both getting either shot or just a lot of trouble anyway, because we have got up to a lot of things over the years.
I'll ask you before we wind up and head off to the show tonight.
We could go all day.
We've only just scratched
the surface. So.
A couple of things I want to ask you. First thing is, when you were a tag team, who were your favourite opponents to work against as a tag team? So,
there was
the Rockers, Hitman Hobbs.
There was no real, because we just, there was no really established teams, was it, at the time? We were just put, and it was two other people a lot of the time, apart from. Kendo Nagasaki and Blondie Barrett.
Yeah.
So there was no real.
That's a good question. I don't,
you know, like, I mean, we ended up having some really good matches with Jimmy Munro and John Pate, like Dave Duran, right? Yeah. You know, we ended up having a bit of a run with them. So we had some. It was always good people. That was the thing. So there's no real. You can't. It's not like we can say we were a few and. Be honest with you, as much of a team as we were, and people seem to still, older fans remember it, we wrestled each other more than we probably ever tagged together.
Yeah.
It was just, sure. It just seemed to be, if you look at the posters, it's always me and him as a team.
Yeah.
But there was that many other things that we wrestled each other just as much as that, you know.
And it's going to be in the hundreds of times you wrestled each other.
Oh, yeah.
Easily.
Oh, God,
easily.
Yeah. Well, don't forget, you know, just talking of that Butlins run, usually it was me on with Robbie. Right, so what's that? Minimum of 10 shows a week.
Yeah.
For 20 weeks.
That's a lot.
And then that's just in one season, just in 20 weeks. So maybe if cut it down and just say five times a week, which would have been more for 20 weeks, there's 100 matches straight away in the 20 weeks.
In one summer season. And we wrestle.
All over the house shows and stuff.
That going back to the you know, as coming from someone who's the pair of us have been around since the Iron Age. But like, you know, you talk about favourite matches and whatever else, and I've never really thought about it. I know you like the one in Brighton. But we did this one. I think it was this American air base in somewhere like is it faking them or something? What? I faking them?
One thing we haven't mentioned. One thing we haven't mentioned was the fans that we had. There was Robbie's. Wasn't so much my fan as Robbie's number one fan.
Right.
Is an old drag queen from Southend called Ruby Venezuela.
Oh, she's lovely.
Yeah, she was. That's the truth. Robbie's number one fan was a drag queen called Ruby Venezuela. That was his act name anyway.
Robert.
Robert used to call him Robert.
Robert.
Oh, Robert.
Oh, Robert. No, but we've done this match at one of the Dominican air bases, and it always sticks out to me because I'd done a slew of these matches before Dan started working for Brian, and they were terrible. And there was one, so we got the stand elevation, and it's like a Tom Cruise film. I got the girl at the end and drove off in this like light ride. I think it was fantastic. But the time before we'd done one of the and like there was a generic bill on thing. I wasn't on the poster, and I said, "Do me on with Brian," and it had younger Polo versus the gay one, and the gay one was a fella called Al Vipond.
I'm gonna make a note here. You never finished the Tom Robinson story. That will finish this off nicely. Right.
Yeah, right. That's how we finish. Right. Yeah.
Okay, so anyway.
Anyway, that was probably my favourite match of all time.
Yeah.
This and you know, so we're driving in the car. This it would have been 83, I suppose. 1983.
Yeah.
And Brian's gone like, sensational, isn't he, Tom Robinson? I believe he's got a song about it. And I should have realised, and I did in hindsight, I'd realised, keep your flicking mouth shut. So he said, he's got a song about being glad to be gay or something, is it? I went, oh yeah, Jeff Wilde's got the EP. Jeff Wilde being the photographer, who was a friend. So Brian said, you couldn't get me a cassette copy of it, could you? That'd be terrific. So it was like an EP, it was like four songs on the two sides of a seven-inch vinyl record. So the weekend or whatever it was, week or 2 weeks later, I'm with Jeff. So I said, have you got that? And he used to have he has like a big shelf of seven-inch records, all like numerical numbers and all in like plastic sleeves. So he puts it on, does me a C30, a Sony C30 copy. Glad to be gay's on the first song. So I give it to Brian, puts it on the car. Oh, starts laughing away to himself. So we're doing a four-man knockout tournament at Minehead. I think we used to do Barry Island or. He's laughing because he knows what's coming from us. So we've done Barry Island. So again, you're getting worked because he didn't do it instantly. You don't want to think about it.
Yeah.
It's very subtle the way he did it. So we're in a four-man knockout. So I think Johnny Sane was there. I was on with Mike Bennett in the first semi-final. Can we have the wrestlers to the ring, please? So Mike Bennett goes to the ring. Mike Bennett goes to the ring, picking on kids and stuff like that, and picking on red coats. Can we have our today's brave hero, whatever the thing? So the next thing. And it goes power to the it goes through all the sort of gay fraternity and whatever. But the chorus, so I've come out and I'm dressed as Ben Truman, so I've got the Dick Turpin hat, the big dressing gown, Brentford nylons, and a shitload of badges with Ben Truman on. So the kids are all going, yay! And I've cottoned on that they're playing this Tom Robinson song, so I'm coming to, I've got, no! And Brian and Mike Bennett are like, tackle, pointing to me and like laughing their heads off. And it comes to this, it's like a big crescendo chorus. Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy this way. Hey. I'm giving that, all of a sudden, take the badges off the kids. I'm going. And he said, no, he told me not to. I was going to play it all the way through. I get it off now. I'm like, hey, come on, Ben. come on, kids. Oh, God. So there's another Buttons one as well. Because Brian's handwriting is disgraceful.
Yeah.
It's a cross between Russian, English, and Chinese. Oh. So when he writes something, like, there was a fella called Steve Prince, and Brian wrote the card out. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in the blue corner from Plymouth, Steve Pringle.
I always thought his name was Pringle. Honestly, I've always thought his name was Pringle. That's what he used to call him.
Pringle, that's because of that.
All right.
Every week, only at my net, he was Pringle.
Good, man. So, come on, you fool. Keep going.
Okay, get it out. So, we used to do Patelli on a Friday, and we were all beat up and we were all tired, and your gear smelt of ammonia, you know, whatever the five sets of gear you got. And it was the Spanish ballroom, and your feet used to stick to the floor. It was all like crunchy, like sugary floor. And it's full of Scousers and full of Manx. So Brian's wrote the script, the thing out. And so, like, I've come to the ring, and like, ladies and gentlemen, his opponent in the blue corner from Liverpool. Yeah. Rupert Brookside. Somehow Robbie turned into Rupert. Brian felt one of the rare times I've shown him on his knees laughing his head off. So I've gone, well, it's not, it says it here. So the next week, Rupert Brookside. So now one of the red coats, Paul McCartney, had We All Stand Together, Paul McCartney and Rupert the Bear and the Frog Chorus.
Oh, the Frog Chorus, and I remember that.
Bomb, bomb, fire, bomb, bomb. Guess who was walking out to it. But we'd get back to Liverpool, like, we'd get back that night on a Friday night, I'd go out with my mates. So the next morning, one of these mornings, I'm at the bus stop with my mate going into town to buy some records. So there's two kids walking down the street, and they stop. And they're like nudging each other, and they're going, Rupert! Rupert! Like, so my mate's going, those kids are shouting Rupert at you. What's going on? I said, just ignore them. Now they're waving, and they go, Rupert! Oh, yeah, you all right, Rupert?
That'll do it. Thank you very much, gents. Oh. You absolute heroes. Let's go to Brighton.
So that was my chat with William Regal and Robbie Brookside. Thank you so much to both of them for giving me their time and coming up with the idea for us to have a chat. There'll probably be a part two at some point because I think we've barely scratched the surface. Really, really grateful to them. Really, really grateful for WWE for letting me tag along with NXT tour of the UK this week. And they were great shows. Next time they're here, try and check them out because fantastic shows to go and enjoy. I think the fans in Aberdeen, in Leeds and in Brighton really enjoyed them. Little plugs on the way out. Don't forget, check out everything on the Distraction Pieces Network. Point people at this podcast via jimsmorman.com/TNJ or tweet me at jimsmorman. Use the hashtag Tuesday Night Jaw. And my little wrestling company, progresswrestling.com, demand-progress.com. More next week. I'll somehow get a podcast up while I'm in America. But there'll be more. Don't worry. Thanks for listening, guys. We'll see you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.